This film, it's called A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night. Charles, nice having you back on.
Good to talk to you, Robert. How's life in Santa Barbara?
It's great. How's life in New Orleans?
It's fantastic. You never commented on the collection of erotic art in the lobby of my hotel.
Yeah, I saw that. And you also sent me a picture of this young woman taking pictures of the erotic art.
Indeed, yes. That's young English guest at the hotel. Perfect Aryan beauty, you know. Can't deny it. The English are a superior race. But I guess what I wanted to talk to you about tonight was not specifically English, but actually Iranian. I'm sure that you're aware that a huge Iranian population has relocated to California since the Islamic Revolution, and even started before that during the Shah's regime. I'm not sure how it started, but there's actually a book called Erangelus. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
I have not read the book, but I'm familiar with it. This filmmaker She grew up in California, and I think she grew up in Palo Alto, to be specific, but she's of Iranian origin.
Right, and it was very interesting because it's a film shot entirely in Farsi, except for a few English language songs, including Lionel Richie and sort of some electric mood music, and it's set in mythical time, basically modern, but not quite fixed in relation to anything historically real. But I found it fascinating because my whole life I've been totally intrigued with the legends and myths of vampires, from way before Dracula, the whole concept of the living dead, the walking dead who live among us, or half live among us, I guess, half dead among us, whatever you want to call it.
There's a theory called the vampire theory, which has been put out by a mutual acquaintance of ours who has gone missing, but he has this theory called the vampire theory.
I didn't know he had actually labeled it the vampire theory. I certainly know who you're talking about, but how would you summarize his vampire theory?
He describes people basically that are degenerate as vampires because they suck the life out of other people, and they suck the life out of other people, and the energy out of other people, and out of the culture and society. So that's his theory.
I don't think it's exactly his. I mean, that's a common notion of vampirism. There are even such a thing as psychic vampires, people who just not by blood sucking, but by virtue of their personality, basically suck, mental energy out of people. People who I can think of certain examples, but won't name any names here. But people who call you repeatedly, asking the same questions over and over and over again, things like that. But you know, in Western mythology, modern, and specifically, I mean modern Western mythology, the vampire has played just a tremendous role over the past 250 years. And I think that that's interesting. Just that fact that the word vampire and the concept of the living dead has become more common in the, you might call it the industrial and post-industrial eras, is sort of a fascinating phenomenon. I mean, you know, earlier mythologies focus on heroes, gods, and dragons, and the spirits of the woods, and basically the unknown in a setting that's kind of away from home, I guess is the best way to put it. I mean, the Iliad, the Odyssey, Gilgamesh, they're all about people traveling and encountering strange things in foreign places. And I guess what's one thing that I see about vampires is that vampires, that they focus on the mythology of the stranger among us, the foreigner who doesn't live in his own country but comes to the storyteller's own country and is basically an alien inside the society where he or she lives. Dracula is a perfect example of that.
He's kind of in American pop culture, he's considered a villain, but he's a folk hero. And he's considered a folk hero in Eastern Europe.
Well, you know, again, there's so much going on here. The concept of a vampire is certainly not heroic in the folk tales of Southeastern Europe. In Greece, you have a near cognate of Dracula, which is Vrikolakos. Vrikolakos is basically a Dracula, a blood-sucking creature, and it's etymologically related to vampire and to dragon. And those are fearful creatures of the night, but still, even in Greece, they live among the local population. You don't encounter them specifically by traveling. I mean, obviously the story of Dracula is the story of an Englishman who does go to Transylvania and encounters them.
He was based on a real person. Didn't he fight against the Turks and he allegedly drank their blood?
Vlad Tepes. Well, again, I don't think that there's much point in. I mean, a lot of people get into this sort of historical roots business, and there was a really terrible movie that came out a year or so ago that was trying to show a direct connection between Vlad Tepes and Dracula and the vampire mythology. And I don't know. I don't get a lot out of that because I feel like up to a point it's just... It's trying to make rational that which is fundamentally mythological, and I think the internal logic of mythology is much more important, understanding why people find certain stories appealing, than trying to pick apart the historical roots and say that it's because of the historical roots that a story comes out a certain way. I mean, in terms of the evolution of the vampire, the consciousness of the vampire, in Western Europe, in the late 18th century, the Austro-Hungarian Empire sort of funneled these stories from Southeastern Europe into the West by way of Vienna, and also the British excursion, Lord Byron's role in the Greek Revolution. You know, he came across some of these stories, and So you get the earliest. I mean, one of Lord Byron's characters, Lord Ruthven. I mean, what's terribly interesting about the early vampires stories is that they're largely aristocratic. Lord Ruthven, the Flying Dutchman, you know, Captain Vanderdecken. He's a very vampiric character, and you know, made it into Richard Wagner's first major opera, The Flying Dutchman. And these are very powerful, mysterious people who, you know, kind of like Dr. Faustus, they basically make deals with the devil in order to obtain great power. And they're always foreign to society, but they're only important when they become, when they come into contact with society. And of course, one of the mythical predecessors of the vampire is also the story of the wandering Jew, the Jew who spat on and laughed at Christ on the crucifix, and he had a vampiric identity, wandering around Europe and preying on people. But you know, he was recognizable both as a Jew and as a demon, and so was the Flying Dutchman. And of course, in the story of Dracula, so is Dracula. When he comes to England, he is both monster and human foreigner at the same time. And I think that's interesting because, you know, contrary to our friend Gonzalo's, why are you laughing? Our friend Gonzalo's or our acquaintance, okay, our acquaintance Gonzalo's, all right. Our acquaintance Gonzalo, his theory of vampires, basically, the original kind of degeneracy, I guess, of the blood-sucking fiend is that it's an aristocratic person, a powerful person who preys on the weak. I was just sort of setting the stage for why I think that this topic is worthy of discussion. It has all these elements of power and ethnic identity that I think are critical to understanding why it became so important in the 19th century and then the 20th century. The power and influence of foreign forces inside, foreign people inside Western society. And, you know, one of the great, after Dracula and all the different variations on the Dracula story, one of the great breakthroughs in vampire mythology, I believe, is the movie and TV show Buffy the Vampire Slayer and its spin-off Angel. And one interesting thing about Buffy and Angel is that the struggle for power between locals and vampires is the focus of that. And basically, there's a huge, unlike Dracula, where there's really only one vampire in the picture, in Buffy, there's a whole community of vampires that lives sort of in a subterranean way in California. And
do you remember then, what Gonzalo said about Buffy?
Oh, not so much about Buffy as about Sarah Michelle Gellar. Yes, I mean, even for your audience, I guess that's a little bit rough. But you know, he made this intensely racist comment. You know, that if all Jews looked like Sarah Michelle Gellar, there would be no such thing as anti-Semitism. Now, that suggests that anti-Semitism has no roots other than looks, and that's perhaps a very shallow analysis. There may be more to anti-Semitism than merely disliking certain foreign looks, but obviously, in the case of Dracula, I mean, he looked like a foreigner, he was easily identifiable as a foreigner in England, and most of the vampires in Buffy, they look different in one way or another, and they're slightly subhuman, but it's permissible to kill them. And this is a whole interesting thing, because the vampire then becomes expressly a symbol in Buffy of the underclass, and specifically the racially defined underclass, and the criminal activities of the racially defined underclass.
Originally that the vampire represent the aristocracy, but then in Buffy the vampire is saying symbolize the underclass.
Well, except that the underclass acquires frequently a lot of wealth and power, even by preying on ordinary people. And the interesting thing about Buffy and Angel is that the people who fight vampires, in other words, vampires are defined as true evil for the most part, a priori, I guess you'd say. They're defined that way, but they can sometimes be ambiguous, and the spin-off Angel is precisely the theme of this ambiguity. Angel is a very aristocratic character. So is Spike, and Angel and Spike in the Buffy series are basically good vampires. Angel because he was cursed by gypsies in Transylvania. Spike basically because he wanted to be good and he wanted to overcome his own vampirism. And so one interesting thing that Buffy does is that it introduces a strong level of ambiguity, whereas really Dracula never does anything good, and none of the other sort of Dracula spin-offs ever do anything good. In Buffy, you get this movement towards the fact that there is such a thing as a good vampire. But since vampires are not recognized by what we call the real world, the real police, the real government, completely ignore and deny, officially at least, the reality of the vampire and demonic extra class, I guess you'd call it, exoclass, I guess. It's outside of the caste system normally, and yet it has certain parallels inside the caste system. And anyhow, all of that is just fascinating, because you go from Dracula to the vampires of Buffy to Angel, who basically is a vampire with a soul, who organizes basically an anti-vampire law firm, first a private investigators firm, and then a law firm in Los Angeles. It's just amazing.
Do you personally identify with a vampire?
Do I personally identify with a vampire? What an odd question, Mr. Stark.
don't you kind of live on the edge?
I don't live on human blood, if that's what you mean. I don't quite understand the nature of your question. I mean, I don't think my fascination with vampires is about really identifying them. I find the whole mythology very interesting. If I were going to be a vampire, I'd certainly like to be either Angel or Spike. I think I'm a lot more like Spike for those of your listeners who know the Buffy series, that I am Angel, but both Spike and Angel are, you know, awfully good vampires, and they end up saving the world on at least two occasions. Although at the end of the Angel series, what's kind of interesting is that Angel, his final battle is fighting sort of a pre-vampire mythological figure. His final battle on the streets of Los Angeles is against a dragon. And that's kind of interesting that that little detail comes forward. But nonetheless, the series Angel ended in 2004 with Angel as a vampire with a soul battling the forces of evil in Los Angeles. And nothing much has happened in the vampire world since 2004, but now, this year, 10 years, we're going on 11 years later, you get this wonderful movie out of Iran. And what's totally fascinating is that this movie completes the cycle. The foreigner is in her own milieu. The heroic vampire, the central character of A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, she is a vampire. She is foreign with regard to the American audience, but she is completely embedded within her own local society.
The society where she lives, it's called Bad City. It's sort of similar to the film Sin City. But it's actually, as interesting as it's actually filmed in a small town. It's a small town kind of near Bakersfield. Is it kind of near the Sierra foothills? But the whole setting is a kind of a, like a eerie feel to it.
Oh, it does, and I mean, you know, it also looks a lot like the south of Iran. I mean, it could be the sort of area around Isfahan and that general oil area. I mean, it has the oil derricks and everything else. It's just a really interesting selection. I mean, if you've been to the sort of Bakersfield, Porterville area, it looks an awful lot like those houses. I mean, you can tell it was filmed in that area. That makes it kind of amusing. But the really fascinating thing is, parallel to Buffy, there is no official state apparatus in Bad City. Buffy is set in the mythical town of Sunnydale, Sunnydale, in Southern California. You know, Angel is set in sort of a mythologized version of Los Angeles. And then this one is set in Bad City, mythologized version of, Central Valley and right on the edge of the Central Valley, but all in Iranian. And basically, I think, with the idea that it was supposed to be in Iran. It doesn't say that, but there's Iranian TV in the background that is making reference to life in Iran proper.
How much importance does the film put on Iranian culture, and does religion play a role in the film?
Well, everyone's conformist with regard to Muslim norms of dressing, put it that way. Everybody is, all the women are wearing chadors. Now the men are basically all dressed in pretty much Western style. The women in private, not in public, but in private settings, you know, they take off their hoods and wear totally Western clothing to dance in and party in, and that's kind of an interesting ambiguity too. Even the vampire girl herself, you know, she puts on this hood, this chador to go outside, and when she's basically stalking, she is in what I guess is an acceptable level of skin coverage for Muslim society. They don't go into any kind of. There are several mentions of Allah, God, but they don't go into any real theological detail about anything. But you know, the whole it looks very much like the same Iran that Mark Weber describes, the same Iranian culture, heavily westernized, but still distinctive enough to be recognized as Iran. And anyhow, like Buffy, a girl who walks home alone at night is about a stateless, policeless society where the only order is really maintained by powerful people, either good or bad. And totally unlike Buffy, the bad people, the drug dealer, the street people, the drug user, these are all humans. And the great enforcer, the moral equivalent of Buffy in this movie, is the vampire herself. And, you know, so we, in a sense, we've come full circle from this hypothetical myth of the vampire as, you know, the defender of Southeastern Europe against the Turks. We've come full circle again from that. You know, Vlad Tepes would have been an original member of his society, an authentic nobleman who had to resort to bloody means to protect his people. And in this movie, we get to see the vampire as basically a police woman, I guess you'd call her, in this case,
or
going around.
A
vigilante, exactly, which is exactly what people have called Buffy and her groups, who are, at least one of my friends who has written about this, has called Buffy and the brown skirts, not shirts, but skirts, because they're all women. And that's kind of an interesting analogy, isn't it, that in terms of the metaphor of the vampire as representing that which is foreign, also that which a threat to the status quo that must be enforced privately because it's not officially recognized, and so only private enforcement works. And in this case, in her native land, among her own people, the vampire is the authority figure who is maintaining morality and the status quo. And a good status quo.
Is she the only vampire, or there's multiple vampires?
You can tell it's a very low budget film. It's a very small cast. A brilliant film, but a very low budget film. I'm sure they've made tons of money because it has gotten uniformly good reviews. And I guess since it's in Farsi, I guess not a huge number of Americans are going to go see it because it just has subtitles and most Americans hate subtitled movies. But it's an absolutely brilliant treatment, but a very small cast. And so in this setting, she's the only vampire we see, and she only kills three people. In the entire movie, she kills three and basically runs off to be the wife or lover of a fourth, which is all kind of amazing. You'd like it because other than the vampire and the guy she ultimately hooks up with, the only character who's in the movie from beginning to end is a cat. The cat goes off with them as they drive off into the California sunset. Or I guess they're driving at night, actually. And that's, she's a very authentic vampire in that. You never see her in daylight. She's only out at night.
So the whole film basically takes place at night.
Except for some of the scenes with, her aspiring lover, the male lead. And one of the interesting things is that she runs off with him. He is kind of, he's a little bit of a thief. So he's kind of on the edge too. And his father was a drug addict, and his father is the last person that she kills. But basically he had acknowledged, even his father had acknowledged, that the father's name was Hussein, that he was a completely worthless, basically degenerate, and that he needed to die to give his son room to live. He was basically a heroin addict. And the first bad guy to be killed is his supplier, his dealer, who basically is he becomes extremely rich, selling drugs and running whores, and the middle person who's killed is just a homeless person, and so you get this idea that. One of the key elements of vampire mythology in all stages, whether it's the Flying Dutchman or Dracula, Buffy, Angel, or A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, every one of those pieces, power exists outside of known social structures. And that's kind of an interesting concept, too, that power is not official government. Power is not the real police. Power is always hidden, whether it's power for good or power for evil. And I think that that's one of the reasons why vampire movies are so tremendously popular in the industrial and post-industrial age, is that people see... There's an evolving archetype, you might say, that real justice and real positive goodness cannot be derived from government. It can only be derived from people or beings who assert the power to do what's right and do it basically without the consent of the governed. So, I mean, that's another aspect of vampire mythology, is it's fundamentally anti-democratic. It's very much about groups of people who arrogate power to themselves because they can. In the case of Dracula, because he's a rich Carpathian nobleman who comes to England. And has basically supernatural power that permits him to prey on the English. In the case of the Flying Dutchman, he's a world traveler who's allowed very little time on land. But whenever he comes to land, he basically tests people, finds them unworthy, and destroys them. And he is finally redeemed by a person who proves herself worthy.
There's a series called Dexter about a serial killer who kills people like they're people who have gone away with murder. Have you seen that?
Well, of course, but Dexter is 100% human. I mean, there's really nothing supernatural about Dexter at all. I mean, that's he is very much a vigilante, like Buffy, like the girl, the vampire in this latest movie, Girl Who Walks Home Alone at Night. He's very much a vigilante. He's a power outside the government. But on the other hand, he interacts with the police on a regular basis. He cooperates with the police. He knows how to cover up things from the police. And there's no suggestion of any kind of supernatural power on his part. He's just an extremely skillful scientist and forensic deceiver, basically. He knows how to fake things. So, yeah, politically, there are comparisons to be made. But on the other hand, he really does work within the system, and the system is part of his life. He's superior to the system in terms of his powers, but you know, there's in the Dexter world of, you know, Miami and Miami-Dade and Southern Florida, there's no escaping from the fact of authority and the world that people see. Whereas in Buffy, Dracula, Flying Dutchman, and this latest movie, you do get completely away from that. You don't see any hint of the status quo that, you know, Time Magazine and the New York Times reports about. None of that is in these major vampire movies. So I think that really the bottom line on this Iranian vampire movie is that it completely turns the recent vampire world around. The girl is a vampire. She's a heroic vampire. She's a moral vampire. And so in that sense, she kind of parallels in Iran what the original Vlad Tepes might have been in 15th century Romania fighting the Turks, if that historical origin had any validity at all. But the other thing is, unlike every other vampire, she is totally part of her community. And you know, one thing she reminded me of, there's a little boy who does not get killed, but he's sort of a street urchin, and she's very harsh with him at one point, and she says to him at one point during the story, "I will be watching you for the rest of your life." Now, what's interesting about that is that makes her sort of a local boogeyman, you know, sort of. She is the creature that goes bump in the night. She is, you know, the bad spirit that'll get you if you don't watch out. You know, all of these things have, you know, grim fairy tales and, you know, local English, Scottish, and Irish fairy tale origins, analogs, of those who are, those who are really and truly part of society, but they will get you if you become a degenerate, basically. And she warns this child of that. And he's, you know, he doesn't do anything wrong. He doesn't get killed. But everybody looks at him kind of askance because he is sort of portrayed as a street urchin, a homeless person. And, you know, this is very interesting to be filmed in Southern California by Iranians, because in a sense it's an acknowledgement by the Iranians that, you know, they feel numerous enough in Southern California to basically be a community unto themselves. That's one thing. And that they recognize as part of their mythology that they need to maintain their own standards of good and evil, totally independent of any local authority structure. What I don't know, and what would be terribly interesting to find out, is if there's any actual vampire tradition in Iran itself. I know that in ancient Mesopotamia, in what's now Iraq and Syria, there were Gala monsters and various kinds of demons at the crossroads who were kind of praying type demons who had a certain amount of power. But I almost wish that we could have Mark Weber on this talk to see if he knows anything about, or anybody who has any knowledge of modern Iranian folk culture and whether they have a tradition of vampires or not, because that's something I haven't been able to find out reading about the background of this movie.
What were your thoughts on what Mark Weber had to say about his trip there?
Oh, well, I mean, I thought it was basically one of the best presentations he ever gave, because he gave a very balanced picture of Iran as, you know, both modern and westernized, and yet somewhat justifiably afraid of the West for what they've done to Iran through the years, which is quite a bit. Very exploitive pattern of, you know, really semi-colonial abuse, and I thought his everything he has to say about Iran is really very good. That, you know, he seems to have very, very strong sympathy for their position in the world, and you know, that they are being, you know, they are being treated as if they were sort of an international vampiric nation. And that's kind of interesting. So I think that we just need more perspective on exactly what Iranian culture is really like, because, you know, a year or so ago it looked like we were on the verge of war with Iran. I haven't had time to keep up with international news recently, but, you know, I'm interested in the clash of cultures. I'm interested in the domination. I spent a lot of time in Beverly Hills last year, more than I've ever spent in my life, and I was just appalled to learn that basically Beverly Hills has become an Iranian city. You know, the Beverly Hills and the Drysdales and the Clampets is gone. The Beverly Hills that I knew when I was in high school is gone. It is an Iranian, and specifically an Iranian Jewish sub-city of Los Angeles right now. And that is kind of an amazing phenomenon, if you ask me. Very surprising.
And I would also say, I mean, that's a subculture to itself, independent of either American culture or Iranian culture. They have their own subculture there.
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, it's specifically Iranian Jewish in Beverly Hills. It's not even Muslim Iranians, or I guess you call them Shiite Iranians. You know, it's specifically the Jewish community, and apparently the Jewish community really did support the Shah, and that's another thought that I wanted to point out, that in the late 70s, before the Shah was overthrown, he was frequently portrayed by Iranians in the West as a vampire himself. The Shah, he was, you know, in caricature or in political posters, he was portrayed as a blood-sucking vampire. And I don't know if that has any connection to the legend of vampires that gave rise to this movie, or if this movie is just a total mishmash of, some people have called it Iranian spaghetti western vampire movie. That's what some people on Rotten Tomatoes and some of the other review boards have called it, and not entirely inappropriate. But I think it's interesting to focus on this movie as part of the past 250 years of vampire lore, because there was only one vampire and because she was a fundamentally good person. We also didn't learn in this movie how you kill vampires. No one seemed to have any clue. Nobody seemed to have guns. Nobody seemed to have knives or anything else.
The other question is, how can she survive? How can she survive by only killing three people? I mean, to survive as a vampire, you would have to kill more than three people.
Well, it was a movie. It wasn't sort of a... It wasn't a... You know, it wasn't a true ecological, biologically sound study of vampires in their Iranian niche.
A moralistic vampire cannot survive.
Well, this one seemed to be doing okay. I mean, the guy she ultimately runs off with, they sort of fall in love, although that's another unusual, tremendously unusual thing about this movie, especially for California, is it's base, even though it's got a love story and a prostitute in it, it's basically a sexless movie. There is no pornography, real pornography in it, except for this gesture of... No, not really. Not at all. Not enough. I guess it would be a PG movie if it were rated. I don't think it was rated, but a little bit more than you might want the youngest of children to see. But totally prudish movie in some ways. And anyhow, I was just going to say that the guy who she ultimately runs off with, the romantic lead in the movie, he offers her food at one point, and she refuses it, and he comments on, you know, how cold she is to the touch, and how he's never met anybody who doesn't like hamburgers before. It's kind of a hilarious thing. To say, he had never met anyone who didn't like hamburgers before, and yet he steals a pair of earrings from a really rich girl, and he gives them to the girl, the vampire girl, and one of the things that sort of one of the ambiguities is she has no pierced ears. And he pierces them right there on the spot with a safety pin, and it hurts her really. It hurts her a lot, but she likes it. And that had a certain resonance to one of the most innocent American movies of recent time, which was called Moonrise Kingdom. I think we've talked about that before, Wes Anderson. And that was an interesting comparison, the sort of rite of passage of ear piercing as almost it substitutes as, you know, a very G-rated loss of virginity or something when a man pierces a girl by piercing her ears.
Well, I'd like to thank Charles Lincoln for being on. That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.